From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with filmmaker Albert Maysles. He and his late brother David pioneered what came to be known as cinema verite, or direct cinema. Their subjects have included the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Vladimir Horowitz. Also today, I talk with drummer Mo Tucker. She was an original member of the Velvet Underground. After a long absence from the music scene, she's back with a new band and a new record. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back on the early days of Motown star Smokey Robinson. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Fords, David Horowitz and Peter Collier's biography of the family that built an auto empire. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Film Forum in New York is about to begin a 25th anniversary retrospective of the films of Albert and David Maysles, two pioneers of documentary filmmaking. The French have called their style cinema verite, but the Maysles have used the less pretentious description of direct cinema. Albert Maysles is joining us from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. He has said, "The essential thing about our films is not making believe, but finding out. Rather than beginning a documentary with a predetermined idea of what they're looking for and then making sure they find it, the Maysles approach is to get to the scene with the film equipment and let the story unfold in its own way. They use no sets, scripts, or narration." Their films include Gimme Shelter, which recorded the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont, where a fan was murdered; Grey Gardens, which is an inside look at the life of Jacqueline Kennedy's eccentric aunt and cousin; and What's Happening, an account of the Beatles' first week in America during their 1964 tour. The Maysles just won two Emmys for the PBS program Vladimir Horowitz, The Last Romantic. A new film, Horowitz Plays Mozart, will premiere at the New York Film Festival. Most of these films were funded from profits from the Maysles' commercials and industrial films. You may have seen some of their documentary-style commercials for Polaroid, American Express, ABC News, and Citibank. David Maysles died in January, and Albert Maysles continues to run the studio. Albert Maysles, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you.
Let's talk about the days in the early 60s when you first started to make documentaries. What were some of the conventions of the documentary form when you started out?
Oh, well, it was a form that didn't and couldn't seem to stand on its own. For one thing, there was no sync sound of a portable nature. If you wanted to get sync sound, you had to plug the big tripod stabilized camera into the wall and get the electricity from the wall rather than from batteries. And all that changed in 1960 when several friends of mine and myself got some money from Life magazine and extended the Life magazine approach of a photographer and a reporter into movie making. The photographer I was one of the photographers, and along with me was a sound man, and that was the whole crew. And in two or three of our major films, my brother and I, who later began our own company, actually in 1962, 25 years ago, that was the crew for Grey Gardens, for Salesman, and it was the ideal way for us to operate it. And it meant that we could tell stories as they were happening rather than have to rely on narration, music, artificial devices that came in afterwards as a way of rescuing something that you just didn't get on its own.
And you wanted your presence as filmmakers to disrupt the action around you as little as possible.
Right, right, because we believed in getting the story itself. That was the revolution in journalism that Life magazine had started. Nobody was going to tell anybody what to do when a photograph was being taken. And we weren't about to tell anybody what to say or to do in filming them. It's an idea that actually was long overdue. It couldn't come about until the technology existed for it, as it was developed in 1960. But I know a good friend of mine, Ricky Leacock, who began this sort of work with me and Don Pennybaker in 1960, when we made a film of the primary election campaign between Kennedy and Humphrey, with Bob Drew also, who was our contact with Life magazine. I remember Ricky said, in 1907, two French cameramen went to Moscow, and they visited Tolstoy to see if they could film him with a camera, of course, that was just a wind-up movie camera. And Tolstoy agreed to it, and he's all excited about it. He said, now it's no longer necessary for anybody to concoct a story, that you could actually go out with a movie camera and film ordinary Russian life. Well, that was the seed of the whole new method of making documentaries that didn't take place until 1960.
Now, you have been the cameraman,
right,
for the movies that you've
made.
Yeah,
but it's along with this whole new way of making films, there was a breakdown of things away from categories of roles that people took. And people who were called editors before took a far greater role in constructing the film than an editor would in a regular sort of movie. The cameraman was no longer a guy that got directions from a director. In fact, the photography in the Hollywood films is still really done by a cameraman who follows the orders of the lighting guy and so forth. But, so that it meant a whole new set of relationships between the people who were working and the people that you were filming.
Yeah, less hierarchical and less strictly defined.
Right.
Nevertheless, you were the one...
Which has a big influence on the kind of spirit that goes into making one of our films. Everybody in the film has something that to contribute, and if it's a little bit out of what he normally does, that's accepted too.
But nevertheless, you were the one who had to lug around the camera.
Right. 25 pounds of it.
Yeah, did you do anything to customize your camera to make it more portable back in the early days when you were starting?
Yes. Well, I redesigned the whole thing so that it didn't need a tripod. It could rest on my shoulders in full balance without even having to support it with either hand. I had it low enough down so that both eyes could look over the camera and see not only what through the camera but also outside of the camera so that I was suddenly a human being rather than just a technical device recording something. And I put an exposure meter at the end of the lens of the camera and so that I didn't have to put the camera down in order to change the aperture as it might change if the light conditions were changing. It put everything at the service of the film and not at the service of the technology or prejudices for example, I mean, until we began making these films, you couldn't get anything in the movie theater or on television unless it was shot in 35 millimeter. So we made terrific efforts to make the 16 millimeter equipment and processing and all of such a good quality that you couldn't tell the difference between that and 35. And so that made for a terrific effort. And not that we cared much whether it was 16 or 35, except that the 35 meant big, big equipment that, again, would require dollies and all that paraphernalia that gets in the way of mobility and also makes anything to do look like a Hollywood production,
right,
which interferes with the relationship that you have with the people that you're filming.
Albert Maysles is my guest, and the Film Forum in New York is about to begin a 25th anniversary retrospective of the films of Albert and his late brother David Maysles. As part of this retrospective, they're showing a 1964 movie that you made called What's Happening, the Beatles in the USA.
Right.
And it's your documentary film about the Beatles' first few days on their first tour of the United States. And it's really an amazing film. I had no idea this film existed. I think very few people actually did. And it's remarkable. You were in the limousine with the Beatles as they were driving around Manhattan to their hotel. You're in their hotel room. You're in all the places the press couldn't get to. How did you get there?
Well, it may be an interesting story just to relate to you how we got to meet the Beatles and film them. We were in our studio one day, and I answered the phone when someone from Granada Television in England was calling us to say that the Beatles were on their way to America. In fact, they were 3 hours outside of Idlewild, as it was then called, which, of course, is JFK. And the gentleman in the other end of the line, I'm mentioning the name Beatles. I held my hand over the phone, and I turned to my brother, and I asked him who they were. Are they any good? And my brother nodded his head as if to say, then they are good, and we should be interested. Anyway, we made our deal on the phone, and since we always have our own equipment, we rushed off to the airport just as the plane was a little pin spot in the sky. We spent the next 3 days with them, and then another three on their trip to Washington and Miami. So there we were with, fortunately at a time in 1964, when the technology and experience that we had been developing for the last 4 years had reached the point where we could come up with something, you know, quite revolutionary. And when the film showed in England that next week, it was greeted as a revolutionary thing in making films. And then, of course, we wanted to get the film shown on in the movie theaters. And, well, we didn't have a release for that, and the Beatles were about to do A Hard Day's Night, which they made maybe six or 8 months later. And Richard Lester saw our film and he used a handheld camera to sort of simulate what we were doing, using a handheld camera filming the Beatles for real, which I think is quite a different thing. And it was quite interesting at that time what they did as was ours. And I think it was not long after that I don't watch television, but you would know better than I, The Monkees, you remember that television show?
Oh, sure,
show?
Yeah, sure.
Using a handheld camera again, but with scripts and so forth, they simulated that style. But I've never been interested in handheld cameras as such, only in as much as it could bring me that much closer to events and people and not to interfere with what was going on.
Sure, but the style started to stand for something.
Yes, yes.
Did you get mobbed by the fans when you were trying to shoot the Beatles?
Well, a lot of the film we did was just with them in their hotel rooms, coming back from the airport in the limousine that they got. When they got to the airport, actually nobody knew at that time whether there'd be anyone at the airport to greet them. 5,000 kids showed up. And then Murray the K, who thought of them as really nothing, it took him a day of seeing what was going on to realize that they really were this incredible phenomenon. And then he jumped on the bandwagon and he became part of Beatlemania himself.
Sure, he became known as the fifth Beatle. And,
right.
And for anyone who doesn't know him, Murray the K was one of the top New York rock and roll disc jockeys at the time. As a matter of fact, I'd like to play a clip from your movie about the Beatles.
Sure.
In which Murray the K goes into the Beatles' hotel room and is doing this kind of interview with them for WINS, the station that he was a disc jockey on in New York. So here's the clip from the Maisel's movie about the Beatles.
We're having a ball. I already saw the dress rehearsal of the TV show, and it's going to be a gas. So there'll be some things for these boys to have. We've got the Meet the Beatles documentary coming up at 7 o'clock, which is in about 44 minutes from now. And how do you like working over there at Sullivan's show?
It's great. We're having a great time. Ed's a great fella. But play some swinging records, will you? None of that drag stuff.
He doesn't want any of that soft stuff. He wants the beat. That's what the boys want to beat. They want to get in the mood for their big performance, see?
This disc jockey Murray the K with the Beatles in their hotel room in 1964. From the Maisel's movie that's about to be shown for the first time since 1964.
Well, it's never been shown as a film, so this is the first time that it'll be ever shown on the screen.
The real question to me about the movie is, how come it hasn't been shown anyplace except on television in 1964?
Oh, well, we contracted to make the film for British television, and in England you don't need a release at all for anything you might do of documentary nature. In this country, you do. And so we didn't need a release and didn't ask for it at that time. But then after we made the film, we asked for the release, but then they were they'd already made a contract with United Artists for their Hard Day's Night, and those people wanted everything to be completely exclusive. So we couldn't get a release for either television or movie theaters, and that had remained all, you know, up until this day. True, we got it, sort of a special grant, which they were very, Apple was very kind enough to give us to show it this one time in this theater in New York City. But we were offered over $1 million to begin with by Columbia Pictures to allow it to be released as a movie at that time. But we couldn't, as I say, we couldn't get that release. We were fortunate enough to get it shown on CBS. We got a release for that once in 1964. That's the only time it's been shown publicly.
So now you'll have control over it again?
Well, it's more complicated than that. The thing is that John Lennon isn't around. He was a big buddy. He moved into the Dakota, and I at that time and still now I live at the Dakota. So he always wanted to do something to get that film shown and to make more films with us. But as you know, the Beatles broke up, and they got connected with all kinds of legal problems that made it difficult to do anything.
My guest is Albert Maysles, and a 25-year anniversary retrospective of his films with his late brother David is about to be shown at the Film Forum in New York. We're going to talk more about his movies after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Documentary filmmaker Albert Maysles is my guest. Let's talk about your 1969 movie, Gimme Shelter, of the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont. This is the concert that ended in the murder of one of the fans. I think it was Hell's Angels who were responsible for the murder. Now, were you filming that as it happened?
Yes. Well, we had four or five camera people there. Most of them got drugged up by being given wine that they didn't know was loaded. And so it was really another cameraman and myself who did most of the work at the Altamont concert. And so for that particular scene, my brother happened to be with the other cameraman, so he's the one that actually filmed it.
What were some of the ethical questions you had to ask yourselves when you got the footage and had to decide how much of it to include in the movie?
Well, actually, we didn't ask any ethical questions.
Really?
Because we felt, we didn't feel a need to, we just, you know, behaved as one normally does in a crisis. And if one is ethical as I think we were, then we did, I think, what was ethical. But there were ethical questions that were raised once we made the film. And one of them was, whether to use the material of a killing in a film. And the New York Times Review, I remember, was headlined "Making a Murder Pay," as if to say that we were very happy that we had the material and that we were using it because we wanted to exploit that fact. But on the other hand, had we not included it in the film, I'm sure it would have been equally unethical since, or immoral, since it was an important part of what took place. Instead of, I think the alternative probably would have been to have made a film like Woodstock, which attempted to make the Woodstock generation and a very happy, unfettered event. And it turns out that it wasn't quite entirely that, nor were the events of Altamont entirely abysmally disaster nature. So I think that we were fair in representing what had to be shown, and fortunately, we were there at the right time to get the killing as well as a lot of other significant things that happened. I mean, significant enough so that I think that the film probably is, in filmic terms, the clearest representation of that generation for that decade.
Did you ever talk to your brother about what was going through his mind when he realized that there was a murder taking place as he filmed?
Well, in truth, he didn't know, nor did I know.
He just thought it was a commotion.
I was only about 20 feet away, myself, filming Mick Jagger. And neither one of us knew what was going on, except that there was a scuffle. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't that ethical question either. Although it's an interesting one, it always comes up in one's mind. Will there be some time in my career as a cameraman where I have to make the choice between stopping a killing or filming it? And I think one is so strongly compelled to tell what's going on as a movie maker that one thinks that somehow or other, if that crisis occurs, that you'll be able somehow or other to do both.
Did you ever have a crisis where there was footage that you really weren't sure you should include?
I can't remember. Well, there've been delicate situations that we've filmed, which perhaps somebody else making the movie might not have included in the film. For example, we filmed somebody at the moment, a man who was in his 50s, who was a public relations expert, who had just been notified that he had been fired. And this could be very embarrassing for him to have the film shown. And so as I began to film him, I put the camera down and I turned to him and I said, I'd gotten to know him pretty well by that point. I said, look, we would like to continue filming if it's okay with you. And he paused for a moment, and he said, okay. And he continued to do what he was about to do, which was to call up his best friend and explain to him all the details of how he was fired and why he was fired and so forth. And it was exactly the man as he really was. And I think there's more ethics, I think, in presenting what's truthful, whether it's painful truth or pleasant truth, than in obscuring it.
But you always run into the possibility of invading somebody's privacy, because we all have thoughts that are true, but that doesn't mean we want to share them with the public.
Right. Well, I think you have to get that permission, or feel that you have it. If somebody doesn't want to share something with the public, then I would go along with that.
You've funded most of your movies not through grants, which is the typical way that documentaries get funded, but rather through making documentary-style commercials and industrials. How come you never went the grant writing route?
Well, I think that, for one thing, by the time you get a grant, having put all that energy into it, it's such a frustrating effort that you might even lose interest in making the movie, or the key elements of what were to take place, you know, had already taken place, and it's no longer a good film. And then you find yourself committed to an organization or organizations that have a hard time, because of the bureaucracy, you know, getting you out of it and slipping you back into another film, which would be more interesting at that time. It's been said so many, many times that that an artist, whether he's a writer or a movie maker, you know, relishes and needs the opportunity to express something that he can't even put into words, except that it's a heartfelt part of his soul that he needs to find expression for. And that sort of stuff that's deep inside you, you can't express unless you were a writer, which I'm not. I can only express it by making a movie, because that's what I am, a movie maker.
I want to play one of the documentary-style commercials that you did, and this one was for ABC News to advertise Peter Jennings on World News Tonight. And it's based on, from what I can tell, it's based on an actual telephone interview that you did with Jennings.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Okay. Let's listen to it.
There was never much doubt in my mind that what I wanted to be was a news person.
45.
I don't know why I work so hard, but I mean, I think it has a great deal to do with trying to live up to the sense that I had at the very beginning.
Good night, guys. Thank you very much.
Which was that if you're going to do this, you know, you really are something of a rare bird. You have a rare opportunity, and you just better not ever goof off on it.
Peter Jennings on ABC's World News Tonight.
And, of course, while we're hearing the audio track in the film, it's showing Peter Jennings in action and doing this interview on the telephone. Mm-hmm. The question that these commercials raise to me is kind of what's the point in a way of getting all this honesty from somebody to just package it in something that's supposed to manipulate the viewers anyways to either buy a product or to tune into a program. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of honesty at the service of manipulation.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. There's more. I don't know quite how to answer that. I don't. There are commercial subjects and products that we wouldn't film. In the old days, we would never make a smoking commercial, for example, when that was allowed on television.
Right, right.
Nowadays, and always, we would. We've had many offers to make commercials for politicians that we wouldn't vote for, and we had offers to do the Ford campaign and also the Humphrey campaign. Humphrey, we liked a great deal, but it was at a time when we thought he had so committed himself to the Vietnam War. We disagreed with that, and we didn't think that he was the right man for president, so we didn't do that campaign. I don't know. You draw the line wherever you can. If we didn't make commercials and corporate films, and we wouldn't do any that we thought were immoral or unethical, what was I going to say? That without doing those, we'd have to commit ourselves to other sources of money where the strings would be drawn on the ethics of our own films.
Right, this form of funding doesn't affect, there's no one to answer to.
Right. We get our money from sources like the commercials and the corporate films, and that's ours to do with it whatever we want.
So you have no network giving you editorial, giving editorial control. You have no granting agency saying these are the guidelines you have to follow, so that you have creative freedom in your movies once you get the money from the ads.
Total freedom. It doesn't. It in no way guarantees that you'll make a profit on the film, but it does guarantee that whatever the film is, it's a true expression of 100% of what you believe.
Albert Maysles is my guest. Your brother had been your collaborator in movies for the 25 years that you were making movies, and he died in January. Has it been difficult to carry on without him?
Well, I want to make clear, too, that almost all of our major films we made in close collaboration with Charles Wehrin, and so that it hasn't been just the two of us.
There's still a team that you're working with.
Right, right.
Well, I'm sorry that your brother wasn't around for this retrospective.
Well, his name is attached to it. as you may know, it's dedicated to his memory.
I congratulate you on this 25th anniversary, and I thank you very much
for
talking with us about your work.
Thank you.
My guest has been Albert Maysles, who, along with his late brother David, pioneered the style of filmmaking known as direct cinema. A retrospective of their work will be shown at the Film Forum in New York City from October 16th to the 29th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with composer and conductor Lucas Foss, who has introduced many American audiences to new music. He's currently music director and conductor of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. The orchestra just celebrated his 65th birthday in a concert at Town Hall, so I hope you can join us. Here's The Beatles, the subject of one of the Maysles' first films. She loves you, yeah. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with drummer Mo Tucker about her return to rock and roll. Tucker was the drummer with the Velvet Underground until they split up in the early 70s. Now she has her own band and a new album. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the early days of Motown Records and how one of the company's first employees, Smokey Robinson, helped make the business a success. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Fords by David Horowitz and Peter Collier. It's a biography of the family behind the automotive empire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The bitter wrangling over the nomination of Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court has ended in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The panel today voted 9-5 to reject President Reagan's choice to fill the vacant seat of retired Justice Lewis Powell. The White House said it was disappointed with the committee vote, but said President Reagan intends to continue the fight. Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd today promised not to stand in the way of full Senate action.
When the committee reports this nomination, I will see to it that the nomination is brought to the floor, called up on the floor, and it will not be delayed. The White House wanted expeditious action on this. The White House did not want it delayed, and so that will be my desire not to have it delayed.
Senate Democrats claim to have enough votes to kill the Bork nomination when it reaches the floor. A vote is expected within the next 2 weeks. The Supreme Court today began consideration of a New Jersey law that allows public school students a moment of silence at the start of each day. The state calls it a time for contemplation and introspection. Opponents say it's a sham meant to disguise the introduction of prayer into the classroom. 2 years ago, the court struck down a similar law passed in Alabama, but the court suggested that not all forms of the law would be unconstitutional. The New Jersey law differs from the Alabama statute because it does not mention prayer. Taxes and televangelists were the subject of a hearing today before the House Oversight Subcommittee. The panel is examining whether tax-exempt religious organizations are improperly using donations for personal or political activities. Subcommittee Chairman J.J. Pickle said the hearing was not meant to interfere with separation of church and state. But Dr. James Kennedy of Coral Ridge Ministries testified that the inquiry is potentially dangerous.
This is a change from 200 years of practice in this country, and that for the first time in the history of this nation, that we find the Congress of the United States investigating churches.
Today's probe grew out of the sex and hush money scandal that rocked the PTL ministry earlier this year. A new educational guide on AIDS will soon be on its way to tens of thousands of teachers across the United States. Education Secretary William Bennett unveiled the booklet today. It urges parents and teachers to tell children that sexual restraint is both a virtue and the surest way to avoid the deadly disease. Bennett says that's not moralizing, it's realism.
Most cases of AIDS result from behavior that can be avoided. And when it comes to the young, nothing more powerfully influences the behavior of the young than their values, their internally held beliefs and convictions. We cannot shy away from associating moral values with behavior. The behavior of our nation's teenagers is the product of the values they hold, not just the facts they have learned.
Bennett says the best advice for parents of sexually active teenagers is to do everything to discourage that activity. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop has advocated that sexually active people use condoms to protect against the disease. The U.S. Coast Guard is heading for the Persian Gulf. Defense sources in Washington said today Coast Guard patrol cutters, small airplanes, and helicopters will be sent to the Gulf to back up U.S. naval forces there. According to one official, Coast Guard vessels will not be used to escort oil tankers. And the stock market took a real nosedive today, dropping nearly 92 points to close at 2548.95. It was the largest one-day drop in the history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Trading was active. 172 million shares changed hands. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the first Motown recording artists to get a hit on the pop charts was Smokey Robinson with his group The Miracles. Robinson is still with the label. He's got a new album, One Heartbeat, and he's currently the only Motown artist near the top of the charts. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of Smokey Robinson and The Miracles and the early days of Motown.
Everybody knows about Smokey Robinson and the Miracles' great string of hits. I counted 32 that made the black charts between 1960 and 1971. Those songs helped to define Motown in the 60s, but you might not know that before those hits came a string of records in the classic 50s vocal group tradition. When they started out, the Miracles were called the Matadors. Like many Detroit vocal groups, they had a female equivalent, the Matadorettes, which included Smokey's girlfriend, Claudette. Her brother sang with the Matadors, but he joined the Army straight out of high school, which was a shame because the group was asked to audition for Jackie Wilson's management a few days after he left. Knowing that they needed five voices to sing the material on hand, Smokey convinced Claudette to join, and then the group threw a bunch of names into a hat, names like the Five Sounds and the Gardenias. Fortunately for us, the name that came out was the Miracles. Smokey Robinson and the Gardenias? The Miracles failed the audition, but met Berry Gordy Jr. there, a young man with plans for a black-owned and operated record company based in Detroit. While he was working on it, he was writing songs for Jackie Wilson and looking for talent, and to him the Miracles sure looked like talent. He sat down with Smokey, and they wrote a takeoff on a popular song of the day and called it Got a Job.
Walked all day till my feet were tired. I was low, I just couldn't get out. Saw a sign in a grocery store. Help is light, and we need some more.
I got a job.
To hedge their bets, they put a standard doo-wop called I Cry on the other side. Gordy got the group a contract with End Records in New York, and they followed up Got a Job, which flopped, with a song that had some elements in it Smokey would reuse later, Mama Done Told Me. Then came a song called I Need Some Money, because Gordy did, and then came the record that became the first on Gordy's new label, Motown. It was a fairly radical song, far from the old group sound, and more in line with what Gordy wanted.
She's not a bad girl because she made me
because she wants to be free.
Bad girl.
Bad Girl almost sunk the fledgling Motown label, though, and Gordy wound up having to lease the rights to the song to Chess Records in Chicago. It was enough of a hit that Gordy finally had the wherewithal to get Motown off the ground in 1959, along with a label called Tamla, for the Miracles' next record, Way Over There. Gordy just couldn't make things work. Way Over There died despite an aggressive ad campaign, and Smokey, one of the first five Motown employees, was busy helping to get the new enterprise going. That wasn't going to happen until the last months of 1960, when a Mary Wells record, Bye Bye Baby, and a Miracles record, Shop Around, put Motown on the map not only of Michigan, but of the world.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, "Son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride." And then she said, "Just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some..."
It would take a miracle to start something like Motown again. Fortunately, in 1958, Berry Gordy had five of them, and one was named Smokey.
You better shop around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is drummer Mo Tucker. She was an original member of the rock band The Velvet Underground, along with Lou Reed, John Cale, and Sterling Morrison. The Velvet Underground combined rock and new music, irony and poetry. Their songs were about things like heroin, kinky sex, street violence, and love. Their records never made it commercially, but they became rock critic favorites, were taken under the wing of Andy Warhol, became central to New York's underground art scene, and then influenced many new wave and punk bands of the 70s and 80s. This is how they sounded in 1969.
Here we go again, playing the fool again. Here we go again, acting hard again. All right. Well, I'm beginning to see the light. I want to tell you, hey now, baby, I'm beginning to see the light.
When the Velvets split up in the early 70s, Mo Tucker virtually disappeared from the music scene. Her fans wondered where she went. Now we have an answer. She moved to Arizona, then Georgia, and raised five children. Now she's making music again and touring with a new band. Her five-song EP is called Mo Jad Kate Barry, named after the members of the band, and it was made during a six-hour session in a garage near Orlando, Florida. Three of the songs on the album are associated with the Velvet Underground, including this one, Why Don't You Smile Now? That's Mo Tucker on drums and backup vocals. This is the only recording she's made since leaving the Velvet Underground, outside of a 1982 solo record that she produced and tried to market herself. That effort was her first step back into the music world.
I was real surprised that people knew my name before I said the Velvet Underground. I was very surprised at that. And apparently that's the way it's been all along, that my name is known, but I assumed Lou and John's name would be known without connecting, but that I would have to say, my name is Maureen Tucker, and I'm from the Velvet Underground.
You started playing drums when you were how old?
19 or 20.
There really weren't many women playing drums then. Did you feel like you would do it in spite of that?
No, I never thought of it. It sounds ridiculous, but I never thought of as, my God, this is highly unusual. I just wanted to do it, so I did it.
Did you know any other women who were playing drums?
No.
Was it hard to, when you were starting out, find bands that would accept you?
I wasn't looking. I was just having fun in my room playing drums.
How did you join the Velvet Underground?
Well, I've known Sterling since I was 12. He was a friend of my brother's. And Lou was my brother's roommate for either one semester or 1 year or something in Syracuse University. And I met Lou through my brother, and Sterling met Lou through my brother also. And when they finally had gotten themselves a job, the band had gotten a job, and they didn't have a drummer, so Sterling said, oh, Tucker's sister plays drums. So that's how I started with them.
Did you have to audition?
Yeah, Lou came out, and he wanted to make sure I could do something. So he said, oh, can you do blah, blah? And I went, you know, smack, smack. And I could do it, so. But that job, it was just supposed to be that one job. And they immediately got another job, and it just kept going from there.
Did any men in the group resist having a woman drummer?
John resisted for a day or two. No chicks, that's what he said.
why did he say that?
I guess he figured it would just make trouble, or I'd be whiny or something.
You had very short hair when you were with the Velvet Underground, and you used the name Mo instead of Maureen. Did you almost try to pass as a man? Because I think actually some people thought you were a man.
Yeah, they did in those days, I guess. No, I didn't try to. That's just the way my hair was. I was never very good at controlling my hair, so it was short, so it would look as inoffensive as possible. And Mo was always my nickname.
When the Velvet Underground was getting started, I think some clubs actually threw you out.
Well, we got fired once or twice.
What for?
We got fired from the Cafe Bazaar because the woman said came up rushing up to us and said, if you play one more song like that, you're fired.
What was the song you were playing?
Oh, God, I don't remember. Probably Heroin or something like that. So we played one more and we got fired.
I really like your singing. Now, your singing really is kind of off key, at least, you know, recorded it is. But it's really good. I really like it.
Well, thank you.
Did you have to be convinced to sing, since you don't sing like a professional singer?
Yes,
you know
I did have to be convinced, yes. We had to clear the studio because after like 6 takes, I realized if everybody was watching me, I would never be able to do it. So everybody had to leave except me and Lou and the engineer.
This is when you recorded After Hours?
Yeah.
So who convinced you?
Lou, he had written the song for me to sing. So, and I wanted to sing it, I was just a nervous wreck.
And if you close the door, the night could last forever. Leave the sun shine out and say hello to never. All the people are dancing and they're having such fun. I wish it could happen to me. 'Cause if you close the door, I'd never have to see the day again. I'd never have to see the day again. Once more, I'd never have to see the day again.
The Velvet Underground never caught on commercially and really didn't get any radio airplay. Were you very frustrated by that?
Yeah, at first it was just a big adventure and it didn't, you know, I didn't care, but it became very evident after a couple of years that the record company was not distributing our stuff at all. It was just a joke. We could have distributed it better if we had sold it at shows. Many times we'd be approached by people saying they couldn't get the albums.
Were you sorry that the band split up?
Yes, very.
Would you have wanted to continue to play?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, why didn't you try to find another band?
Well, after playing with the Velvets, that didn't seem like a... I wasn't interested.
Did you miss music when you gave it up?
I sort of didn't at first, I guess I was just sort of in shock and just made myself say, oh, well, now it's over. And then when I started recording my silly little single in Phoenix, I began to wish I had someone to play with and to really miss it more. That's when I really started missing it, I think.
What kinds of jobs have you held since leaving the band?
Just data entry or programming.
Do the people who you've worked with know about your other life in rock and roll?
Well, this group I'm with now, the place I work now, they know that I used to play drums, and you know they asked me to bring in an album, and I showed it to them, but they have no idea what the group was about, or, you know, they just don't realize.
Is it alienating to be around people who don't know about that part of your life or about that talent that you have?
Alienating only because it's frustrating to hear the music that they like to listen to. Whitney Houston and Lionel Richie and all that stuff hour after hour, and it just drives me crazy, and they love it and they think it's wonderful. I've brought in a tape once in a while just to have my say with like Bo Diddley on it and things like that, and The Who and The Stones and, you know, that kind of a collection of things. And, oh, they just can't stand it. They think it's horrible. And that just blows my mind, because these are not 60-year-olds. These are young women, you know.
What does it feel like to be playing again?
It's great. I'm really enjoying it.
What would you like to see happen with your band now or with your music career?
Well, I would like to try and get into producing. That's something I never really thought of until a few years ago, but I would really like to try producing. And I would like to get it so that I was earning enough money that I could quit the lousy little job I have and concentrate more on trying to make something out of music.
Mo Tucker, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mo Tucker recorded her album Mo Jad Kate Barry on 50 Skidillion Watts. That's a new label started by Velvet Underground fan Penn Jillette of the magic team Penn and Teller. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Brenda Wilson, who is co-hosting this evening's program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Brenda.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Today on All Things Considered, we have a report from Nina Totenberg on the Senate Judiciary Committee's vote on the nomination of Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. There's also a story on a pediatrician, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, one of the nation's top experts on infant learning, who tells us how a newborn child views the world. And we'll have a report on an AIDS booklet that is put out by the Department of Education for teaching school children about the disease.
Thanks, Brenda. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of The Fords by Peter Collier and David Horowitz. It's about the family whose automobiles first put America on the road.
Peter Collier and David Horowitz used to be muckraking journalists for the old, sassy left-wing Ramparts magazine before they started writing what might be called prime-time biographies of families like the Rockefellers, the Kennedys, and now the automotive Fords from 1896 to 1986. By prime time, I mean the sort of dynastic bestseller that reminds you of a TV miniseries or a soap, in which the rich are punished for their money by bad luck and bad sex, and the rest of us feel better, we even feel edified, watching them break their toys and lose their souls. You will enjoy the Fords and then hate yourself in the morning. Collier and Horowitz aspire, of course, to something loftier, a tragic afflatus. They mention Oedipus, by which they mean both the monarch in Sophocles and the complex in Freud. They mention Shakespeare, by which they mean the mad king, Henry I, the doomed prince, Edsel the Never-Ready, and various dangerous usurpers, the guys who tried to steal the family jewels. From Harry Bennett, with his silk shirts, his mob connections, and his union-busting goon squads, to Robert McNamara, the whiz kid accountant with, quote, no feel for the product, to Lee Iacocca, a one-man cult of his own personality. By the time Collier and Horowitz get to Henry II, grandson of the Model T, company redeemer until his death last month, and legendary rightful heir, they are comparing him to Prince Hal and Falstaff and Odysseus, whereas they only compare his grandfather to, quote, some god of Oriental mythology, simultaneously creator and destroyer. The trouble is, these Fords don't speak Elizabethan English or ancient Greek or Sanskrit. Their language and manners never really left the family farm. They aren't big enough to carry this symbolic weight. The bottom line on Henry II is that in the last few fiscal years, he sold more cars and made more money than General Motors. This isn't exactly Aristotelian tragedy. It's not even Restoration melodrama, although Collier and Horowitz try hard, asking us to believe that the second Henry avenged his father, the hapless Edsel, at the expense of his grandfather, the first Henry, anti-Semitic crackpot, soybean fetishist, hater of jazz and golf. Pathetic only child Edsel, the man, not the machine, who dreamed in vain of front-wheel drive and independent suspension, dies powerless at 49, without having figured out that his father's real children were the Tin Lizzie, the assembly line, and the company spy. The rest is gossip. Four generations of Fords, with too much dough and not enough taste, descended into mistresses, land grab, conspicuous consumption, alcoholism, megalomania, and Eurotrash. In their lifespans, old Henry popularized the Protocols of Zion in his own vicious newspaper distributed through his dealerships. And his son died of a broken heart. And his grandson rediscovered sex. And his great-granddaughters ran off with Italian ski bums and Greek shipping magnates. And all of this is very sad. But we're still talking about guys who made cars, not the fate of nations. Maybe when America motored off the farm, we lost our way. But the Fords seems to be about something else. It seems to be about the trouble a country gets into when the peasants have money.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The Fords by Peter Collier and David Horowitz. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Stuart Berg Flexner, the editor of the new Random House Dictionary of the English Language. It's the first new unabridged dictionary in over two decades. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the new album by pop vocalist Joe Stafford and her husband, bandleader Paul Weston. Under the names Jonathan and Darlene Edwards, they do intentionally bad, screechy, off-key versions of pop, jazz, and avant-garde music. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss the new popularity of Italian words, particularly to describe products with a cosmopolitan feel. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Research assistants from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.